Welcome to the Underwater Podcast, where we take a deep dive into the world of underwater portrait photography, cinematography, and everything in between, with your host, Brett Stanley.
Welcome back to the Underwater Podcast, and this week we're chatting with Christina Karlajek-Skoglund, an underwater wildlife and feature film cinematographer. Christina grew up on the coast of Sweden, dreaming of shipwrecks, but it was a trip to New Zealand and Australia as a teenager that really gave her a taste for the underwater world of film. We talk about her work with the BBC and National Geographic, and how she was massively inspired by her aunt, Jutta Hossel-Waters, one of the first women to officially work in Antarctica out of Australia in 1976. Okay, let's dive in. Christina, welcome to the Underwater Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me here. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Where are you at the moment? I know you're based in Sweden. Is that where you are right now?
That is also where I am right now, yes, on the west coast of Sweden in Gothenburg.
Oh, nice. Cold at the moment?
It's slowly getting warmer, but we've had a dark, long winter time.
Yeah, I bet. Do you get the kind of days of night kind of thing? Are you that high up?
No, I'm not that high up in Sweden. So I do get more like a bit of coastal weather here with its, just more windy and sometimes rainy. But yeah, I've got a coast and water.
Oh, that's good. Considering what you do, which is an amazing wildlife cinematographer, how did you kind of get into that?
Well, it is a longer journey, I should say. But I do think it started out somewhere with me growing up in the Netherlands, actually, at the North Sea. And I was out with my family sailing a lot as a child. And I spent a lot of time just playing by myself, at the coast and living and being on a sailing boat and just being exposed to water a lot of the time. And I think that sort of laid the stone for me being so curious what's happening below the surface. And I was always looking at the sea charts as well as a child and just mapping out where all these wrecks were indicated. And it just got me really interested. And the same with marine animals. I knew everything about, all the marine animals at that coast where I was living. And I even knew then already that there were sharks in the North Sea, which not so many people knew about. And still, it was like very cold, very murky water. So I didn't even know any divers when I was a child, unfortunately. It's not necessarily very inviting waters to be diving in, even though now as an adult, I know better.
So growing up like that, so tell me about the climate there. Is it the sort of place where you're like jumping in the water and is it warm enough in the summertime to be swimming?
Well, casual? I mean, that's what we do. That's what we did, of course. But for a lot of other people, it would be still way too cold. So, summertime is better for swimming because the air temperature is warmer, but it would still it's still where a lot of people don't even go into the water. But I think, I guess you get to to learn that. And also I had, my grandmother, she actually taught me as well to do like cold water showers when I was a child, when I was a young child. So I guess I got a bit of exposure to the cold.
It toughened you up at an early age.
Yeah. But again, no, it wasn't. It was, it's still been really something that has just caused so much imagination for me. The sea and what's below the sea. And of course, I mean, I've grown up at the coast, which can be rough, I also knew always about how, how dangerous it can be. And I knew also about stories of people that had gotten lost at sea. There's a lot of fishing, you know, commercial fishing activity in that area. A lot of people work like in oil industry on the North Sea or work at the Coast Guards and at sea rescue. So yeah, I knew about that side of the water as well. And obviously sailing, and, you know, sailing also like for several days without seeing any land. Definitely experienced some rough weather as well as a child.
So you had a good idea of the dangers of the ocean as well as just how beautiful it can be.
Totally.
That's incredible. So what sort of, like, were you literally born to and then hopped on a boat, or did at a certain age you started sort of being on boats?
I think I started being at the age sort of from 5 or 6 years onwards on boats. And I'd say the sailing boats like grew slightly over time in length. So
right.
First it was a very small boat for our entire family, and then I think my parents got, you know, sort of slowly upgraded gradually,
right?
And that's also how we got to sail longer distances. But I wasn't living all the time on boats, but it's pretty much what my parents did in almost all of their spare time. So
right. So it's kind of people with RVs and caravans like go away for holidays and weekends and stuff. Is that sort of thing where they take you guys away?
Yeah. And I would just also like just hang out with my dad when he was, you know, fixing stuff on the boat and repairing. And basically, he would just take me along, and, you know, I just had to play and come up with something while he was busy doing oil changes and that kind of stuff. And
so you had to entertain yourself, basically.
A lot, definitely. And I'm also a bit like a little bit younger child. I've got two older sisters. So definitely got to play and explore a lot by myself.
Right. And so I guess that's when you started to kind of imagine what these, you know, what these animals were doing under the water and you know, these shipwrecks. And was it very kind of like a adventurous kind of thing? Like you wanted to go and see these shipwrecks and kind of and discover shipwrecks?
Yeah, I thought that was very, I was totally also in that age when I was fascinated with all sorts of like adventure and exploration stories. And of course, and I mean, shipwrecks are such a, you know, sunken treasures and shipwrecks and, you know, what has happened in that moment, those things I was, you know, just spiraling my imagination with. And at the same time, just sort of imagining what else was living underneath the surface was interesting, because again, it was very difficult to see from the surface because it's a bit of like tidal water, so it's quite murky, a lot of sediments, and the further you go offshore, the clearer it will be, but still, you know, it's, you can't really see, so it's even more like, you know, you need to read it in books and learn about it somewhere else.
Is there a lot of mythology in the Netherlands in terms of in the ocean and stuff? You know, like when you're a kid, you kind of get caught up in, you know, the fantasy world of stuff. Did you kind of, was there like local legends and stuff that you kind of thought about?
It wasn't too much local legends. I like sort of seafarers lore there's a little bit, but it was mostly more through like also the books I was reading at that time, like, just sort of adventure fantasy stories, and, you know, just sort of that was what I chose to pick in the library, and more that, I'd say.
So when do you feel like you actually got to go on your first real adventure?
So I think my first real adventure was it was in New Zealand when I was about 16 years old, or maybe even before. I was actually like, I went as, I was a bit of involved in this sort of eco-activism scene in because I later on moved to Germany, and that's where I got a little bit more into sort of like environmental European movement, and also a bit more into the activist side of things. And I think I went when I was 14 or 15, I went on my own to this, yeah, like this summer camp in southern France, which was also like a sort of this European action camp. And I mean, even at that time, like, you know, it was all about sort of climate change and, yeah, working out strategies and how to communicate that. So I think it was definitely a big adventure to be, to be traveling at that age.
So when was this? Do you want to date yourself?
90s yeah, this or? Was more, I think this was in the 90s. Yes. Sort of mid 90s.
So kind of before the internet really and sort of
yeah,
that.
Yeah, it's just, you know, that it just, it feeling. Had just started, it had started. So yeah, I think, you know, email addresses existed. So emailing was on the horizon. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I actually had the opportunity, which was just such a fortunate opportunity, to go and live in New Zealand for a year as an exchange student. And that was inspired because I actually wanted to go to Australia because my aunt lives in Australia or has lived in Australia, and she was a photographer. So I basically wanted to go and stay with her, but I think they were a bit like, okay, well, you know, that's just not going to work out so much because they're busy working and maybe there are no other children around. And yeah, so.
Right. Yeah. not so convenient.
Not so convenient. But again, I was very excited to be traveling to New Zealand at the age of, I think I was just like 16 and a half. And getting to this country, which had also this very sort of magical appeal to me. And just also being, of course, on the other side of the world. But again, since I had a lot of inspiration as well from my aunt in terms of photography, that really, was on the other hand, very close. Like, because I had been getting all these books as a child from my aunt, Australian children's books. And my aunt was actually a photographer who traveled to Antarctica for a long time. And she worked as a senior photographer for the Australian Antarctic Division. What was even more special about it is that she was one of the first women that were even allowed to travel to Antarctica. And out of Australia. And it's like, this is, you know, this is not very long time ago. I mean, yes, but still, I think when she started working there, they had a policy that no women were allowed to work in Antarctica for, official organizations in Australia.
And so what was that, like the 70s or?
I think that was the late 60s.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So, my aunt was a bit like, so, but why? I just had a new colleague here starting at the department who is going to Antarctica, and he just started here. Why can't I go? I'm his supervisor. And they were like, sorry, this is against our policy. So she actually, and this is something I just heard a few years ago, She actually had to write a letter to the Premier of Australia to ask if she could go to Australia, to Antarctica.
Wow. To like ask permission to get down there.
Yeah. And I think actually, so what happened was that she did get an answer 1 year that she could go for the next summer season. She could go down to Antarctica and work on one of the Antarctic stations. And after that, she traveled, I think, for over a decade every year as a senior photographer. Just like documenting the life at base there, but also wildlife in Australia. So that's why we had all these beautiful black and white photographs of my aunt, penguins and icebergs and and the Arctic landscape, but also just sort of some of the photos, sort of more documentary style photography of life in an Antarctic station. So think that definitely. So yeah, that was so it was really an adventure for me to be going down to New Zealand and eventually also to Australia to finally meet my photographer aunt and her husband. So,
and so you knew her, like, had you met her at all, or did you just sort of hear about her through the family? Or,
well, so my aunt had been, and my aunt and her partner, they had been traveling to Europe, occasionally. So I had already met them in Europe before, but still, it was. When I actually went to visit her, I went on this, just like a safari with her, I should say.
Oh, wow.
Just sort of photographing plants and, just going to rainforest and just going like alongside her. And, she did teach me some of her photography skills. And that was really fascinating.
And is that where you kind of got a taste for the photography and the cinematography side of things?
I think it started earlier, in fact, but it started much earlier. But again, I think when I lived in New Zealand, I spent a lot of my the high school breaks in the dark room that the high school had. So that was just magic place for me.
Where in New Zealand were you?
I was in a small town called Levin, that's north of Wellington on the North Island. And I think, and maybe some of the New Zealand audience will laugh a little bit now, but what they told me when I came there, they were like, okay, you live in Levin, you die in Levin. So,
Yeah, Levin, I know Levin quite well because I lived in Wellington for 10 years.
Oh, no way.
So, and Levin, it's a beautiful, beautiful little town.
Yeah. But honestly, I mean, I had a fantastic time living there. I made wonderful friends. And I learned a lot, like coming from this sort of big, crowded Europe with, just so much going on. It was really interesting for me to be in a much smaller community and even in a country that has a different context by being a bit more isolated. I mean, I think it is fair to say. So I learned like much more of sort of this Kiwi attitude of, okay, yeah, you can do it, just go for it, mate. If you've got an idea, just do it and not like, oh, how many other people have done this before me? And, it's like sort of, I had learned much more to be, doubting my own ideas and thoughts, because probably already like 100,000 people who have done the same. And that was something I appreciated a lot in that time. And I learned to surf, so that was awesome.
Yeah.
I made a lot of really good friends.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, there is this kind of thing in New Zealand and Australia as well, which is, kind of do it by by the skin of your teeth. And there's a saying in New Zealand where it's like you do it with number 8 wire, which is, the wire that you use to make fences.
Yeah.
And it's just like you can do anything with that. It's like gaff tape.
Yeah.
And it's really just this can-do attitude of, just try it.
Yeah, yeah.
See if it works.
Replace that later on with gaffer tape and cable ties.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that's great. So how long were you in New Zealand for?
Well, that was just about a year. I had to go back to Europe. And I actually moved to Berlin in Germany, and I was really lucky to get into this training program at a German foreign service broadcaster based in Berlin. So that was television, and I basically got to learn for 3 years pretty much everything you need to know for broadcast production. So sound technician, camera assisting, camera technician, working in studios, editing was a very, very important component to it as well. And some about graphics and some about, just especially a storytelling component. So, it was in cooperation with theory courses and and training at the German broadcast school. So it was a really hands-on training and education, but with and that was very important, I think, for me at that time, because I went up to my dad when I was like a month into the training, and I went like, "Hey, why didn't you teach me soldering?
Oh,
why didn't you? obviously learn to solder cables and fix stuff, and take cameras apart and build them together again, and so that was extremely, extremely useful, basically.
Oh yeah. Did that harken back to the days when you were just sitting next to him on the boat while he's working on the engine and stuff?
Well, I mean, a bit, yeah.
Do you wish he'd paid a little more attention then?
Yeah, I think so. You know,
It is amazing though. So my dad's a builder, and so when we grew up, he was always building houses or all these projects and stuff. And I don't remember really paying attention, but now in later life, I kind of remember all the things that he did, and I feel like, I kind of did pay attention, in the peripheral. So I kind of go, oh yeah, that's how Dad used to do it. Or that's why this works that way. So I feel like these kind of skills that, we kind of think that we didn't really pay attention to, but they're in there somewhere. I think they're kind of built into us.
Oh, totally. I think they are. And I mean, just sort of seeing people fix stuff. And I mean, I did help and do things as well. But again, I think some parts were overlooked that would be, an always ever useful life tool to learn.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. At what point did you then start to go underwater with cameras?
Yeah, that happened not too long after, actually, because I wasn't a diver at that time, but I really desperately wanted to. But then I think I had this job in New Zealand as an AC, and I just stayed on, and I just stayed with some friends, and I decided, okay, this is the time when I'm learning to scuba dive. So I actually learned to scuba dive in Wellington. It's back in New Zealand. Learned to scuba dive.
Yeah, right.
And I pretty much knew that I was wanting to go and, implement that into my work. I wanted to factor that in, and even if it was just working as an underwater lighting assistant or something, but I,
right.
And then as soon as I started doing my scuba course, and it wasn't, it wasn't a paddy course, but it was actually like, coming every week and, sort of taking a longer time to learn it. And I think no one showed up on the day of the test because it was rainy and stormy, but I was the only one. I was like, I want to do this. I want to keep going.
Yeah. But you also probably grew up in pretty similar weather, like cold water and terrible visibility.
Totally. So I think it was like a harbor dive and, just saying hi to two crabs or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
But again, not much distraction and do all the drills and stuff. So, but
that's awesome.
And then after that, I think I went up to this amazing place in New Zealand, the Poor Knights Islands, which are these, just like islands a bit offshore, a little bit offshore, not too far, I think an hour drive. And they are like, they're this sort of karst type rock islands. And what's so special for me at that time was that I got to dive into sea caves. And as this is karst stone, the islands are literally having all these holes in it, and light shines in like sort of this perfect cathedral light. And at the same time, the seafloor was sandy, and it was this very coarse white sand, but with gigantic ripples on it, I think, from obviously stronger currents. And it was just such a perfect setting for me to be completely blown away that I was like, okay, you know, this is 100% the underwater world that I want to keep exploring. And this is 100% what's fascinating and captivating me as a photographer. So, yeah.
it's so interesting that that's where you kind of had that sort of epiphany, because it's, you know, I've dove the poor nights and it's such a beautiful space. And it is so like the opposite end of the world visually from Wellington.
Yeah.
You know, it is like it's night and day.
Absolutely.
So that's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, and then it's like you're swimming out of that cave and then there's rays and, you know, it's this beautiful, slowly swinging kelp and still very clear visibility. And then you're just swimming out to the outer side of the islands and boom, it's completely blue and you're just on the lookout for megafauna to possibly just suddenly pop up. And it's...
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, because I think orcas swim around there.
Yeah, they definitely, orcas and whales and, I mean, rays. So it's just, it can happen, totally. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's where you learned to dive. And did you actually do any underwater filming or anything in New Zealand?
I don't think I did any filming. I did have like I did have a small underwater photo camera, but I didn't do any filming yet. So I think I had to go back for that back to Europe. And I think I just started bugging everyone I knew if there was any opportunity to be underwater filming or if they needed some kind of underwater shots. I was just, you know, just telling everyone I was there to be doing it. And yeah. I was very, I think I was lucky that one of the camera people I had been working with in a team with for quite some years as a camera assistant, he tipped me off a company in Germany that was focusing on underwater work. And I just, and the advert that they were looking for an intern. So I went to talk to them and that's where I started.
Oh, great.
Yeah. And when I went with them, so that was with underwater cameraman Thomas Behrend. I went with him to Mozambique, worked on the story or natural history program on manta rays.
Right.
Yeah. And it was like, okay, that was, I learned a lot. Yeah, just sort of, yeah, it just was a lot learning by doing. And at the same time, I was quite, I found it quite challenging dives as well. So, and I think I had to, sometimes I was a bit like, okay, you know, people were giving me these looks when they were seeing my logbook, because I didn't have that many log dives actually. And, people were going like, yeah, you need to be a really good diver before you can even have a camera in your hand. And I think, you know, as I had come from the camera side, I was basically the opposite. So, but on the other hand, I knew, of course, about film productions, because that's where I had worked and even in different areas, not just with television, but also with feature films. I've worked for commercials, with car commercials at that time, and a whole range of production styles. And also I had, I was shooting topside on land. So I think that gave me, of course, a lot of confidence, because I knew what we were after, what we were trying to do. And I mean, mostly.
Yeah.
So, that's how I basically got to experience and work with manta rays on my first underwater shoot. And
which is amazing.
Yeah. And also learned immediately like the hard, brutal sides of natural history wildlife filmmaking, because on that trip I think we had really terrible conditions for 2 weeks, like almost no mantas, this was in Tofu in Mozambique, which is quite a known site for yeah, for manta rays. And yeah, we got, it was bad visibility, green water and no mantas that were coming to these cleaning stations. So these places where right. the mantas make use of like the reef fish that will come and pick off parasites and will clean them. So
yeah,
no mantas. And we were fighting very hard, getting up really early, long days out at sea, trying and not getting anything for 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And then I think like on day 15 or maybe it was also day 20, I don't know. But then finally, boom, watercolor changed. Everything changed. Mantas were back.
Oh.
And yeah. we were just, yeah, filming. It was amazing. And just mantas circling around. And yeah, just total carnival, basically. And we got back yeah. on land, checked footage, and there was an error. So a lot of like the camera had created some error, and basically the most important shots were destroyed. And that was like,
God.
Oh my God, I can't believe that. It's true.
And was this digital?
Yeah. And it was like corrupted or it was, I think, yeah, it was corrupted. I think it was corrupted files. And I mean, and we were continuing again to be filming, to shoot a dolphin story. It was just, we were so devastated and it meant a lot of hassle at that time because we had to, even though we had, you know, 2 underwater units, we had still could only work with one and just everyone was so down after this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess because you're out there and you can't take the camera back and get something fixed because you're out in the field.
Yeah, we were already out in the field and, you know, just even exchanging and getting things fixed takes, you know, it takes a while. It takes like, yeah. So it was a hard experience. But on the other hand, I totally kept going and
yeah.
I got to continue to work with this company, which is called Blue Planet Film, based in Hamburg. And and not only underwater, but also topside. And because, yeah, I think it just became both useful to be for some of the shoots be filming on the water and for some of them to combine it with filming on land. And I think I got to go back again to New Zealand as well to do an aerial shoot because someone else had dropped out. So, you know, it was like, okay.
Oh, right.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's been quite a busy and exciting time. But I would say like what I did when I got back from shoots was I went off and I went because I was living in Berlin. My closest oceanic water or somewhat oceanic water was the Baltic Sea, which is about 2 hours drive north of Berlin. So that's where I went and as much as I could to just train underwater filming myself.
All right.
Because,
so like personal projects?
Yeah, I just started doing personal projects. But to be honest, I bought a small camera and underwater camera and I just started just practicing with it because I didn't know where else to go. I didn't know except for my mentor at the company where I was working as an intern, I didn't really know where else I could learn more. And I really desperately wanted to learn more. And I figured, okay, I've got to, you know, train my swimming style. I've got to change how I move. I got to change how I'm thinking underwater, how am I communicating? Well, okay, obviously that's not when you're going on your own, but but
so you're actually diving by yourself when you're doing these?
Yeah, when I was doing that, I was most of the time diving by myself. I did go also, I did go just do shallow, I did I thought that was okay to be doing shadow stuff, but just by myself. And, you know, because it also just gave me the time to just try everything and to, you know, just really try on perfectioning my shots. And at the same time, I also, I did a lot of like dive training to get better at diving. And I did a lot of like wreck diving in the Baltic Sea, which again, that I didn't do by myself.
Yeah.
I started diving on some shipwrecks because of course I was, trying to learn more, trying to experience more, trying to explore more, but also training. And then I realized, because at that time, as I was working out of Germany, I realized, okay, there isn't really a formal, sort of certificate I could do as a commercial diver, because I looked into commercial diving licenses, but that required that I was a welder or some kind of, craftsperson welder.
Like a tradesman,
A tradesman, which I wasn't. And neither was I associated to a university to do the sort of European scientific diver education, which wasn't possible at that time for real for me either. So I was in this space in between, and I just thought, well, okay. Apparently also the type of work I was starting to do with filming underwater is, doesn't help if I learn about commercial type diving as a welder. It won't help me at all. So, and that was basically what I understood that all sort of senior people around me were doing as well. So I thought, okay, what can I do to be a better diver still? And that's how I got into cave diving. I was looking both sort of to be like reconnecting as well with this experience that I had in New Zealand with diving into the sea caves. And so both being like visually really interested in that environment and in that sort of hidden world, and at the same time really wanting to learn perfect buoyancy skills. Also just basically basic survival skills as a diver. And I was talking to people and they were like, I know these people in Mexico and you could go there and I've been there. And I was like, but that's in a wetsuit. I don't want to do that in a wetsuit. I want to dive in a dry suit. I want to do it in the cold water. So that's when I started going to Sardinia, which is an island in the Mediterranean Sea. And they are also, again, inland caves, but cave systems, actually. It's a bit like a Swiss cheese, the whole island, really. But again, most of the entrances are from the sea. So you have quite a rough entrance, swimming against the flow and the sea and the surge pushing in. So that was definitely a tough training that I got.
But do you kind of thrive in that sort of situation? Do you like the toughness and the challenge of those sorts of things?
I think I do. It took me a while to understand that, but I definitely do. I think, and it's something I reflect a lot on. I feel that almost every shoot I do something that's completely new, and I just love it as well, because I love getting into finding out, figuring out how I can do that, or just coming up with ideas how I can do it better. And sometimes looking back at some parts where I've been working in previously in other camera genera or other sectors, it feels more like the camera you're working with. There are challenges, but some of the parameters are the same, and I feel with what I do nowadays, there's always something that's very new to it, either a new piece of kit that we've custom built, or it's a completely, it is still a new diving situation. And even now, like having dived under ice so much, it's still every dive site is almost a new place, is a new situation. And I love also that, you know, that adrenaline bit as well.
Totally. Do you find, like, equipment wise, do you find that you're basically trying to repurpose things that are made for other industries to be able to do the thing you need to do for the film side of things?
Yes and no. I mean, totally. It depends also what I work with, of course, because I've also my main work is within the wildlife filming sector, really, underwater. But I do shoot for feature films underwater, or short films or dance films underwater too. So that is, again, a very different environment and a very different setup. I've come from basically areas which had, like, maybe some more less regulated diving styles. And now I work, of course, also a lot in, extremely professional teams where we work, of course, under certain parameters in the way we operate and how we handle safety and all that. So it is, it's the commercial diving world that comes together with the recreational diving styles, because obviously we can't do surface supplied helmets, big boat operations with a team of five people, because that's both, like, logistically not possible, budget-wise it's not possible, and also for getting done what we want to do. But again, I know we're on a photography, underwater photography podcast, so I don't think it's news to a lot of the people that are listening. But again, I think it is, it's sometimes definitely a challenge. But I think one of the pieces of equipment that's both coming in from military and from recreational diving side of things is our rebreathers. That has really changed my life a lot, and in so many ways. And I'm very grateful about that.
So in terms of the rebreathers, what would you say are the main benefits of that in terms of you being able to get the shots and everything you need? What are the main features that it has that make things easier for you?
It just enables me to do completely different shots underwater, which would otherwise require that, changing cylinders in between. I mean, of course, when I'm working at the depth of, like, say 5 or 10 meters, yes, that can be done on open circuit scuba, but still you'd have to go up after an hour to change your tanks. And I can just, with our team, we can just stay down and keep working. So basically, if I'm starting to set up, like, underwater sliders and underwater grip, that's basically after an hour. I've got everything set up after an hour, and then I start working. So I don't have to think about coming back to the surface, but I can keep going. And I mean,
so it gives you a lot longer bottom times.
It definitely, and also it gives me quietness, which is, I think, both really important for wildlife and also for myself, my own peace of mind and for my own working environment.
Yeah.
And it's warm air, which is beneficial in cold water.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and also, yeah, more sort of moist air as well.
Yeah. So you're not drying out the whole time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that's such a benefit. Obviously, it doesn't work in every environment, and not every job is a perfect rebreather job. For some of them, it's not the right tool. But again, for a lot of them, it's a fantastic tool. And also, even I use it even in pool work when shooting, towards surface. I don't have to hold my breath or anything.
Oh, that's true. Yeah, because then you won't see your own bubbles in the footage or anything.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, so when you're doing something where you're, you know, like you say, you're setting up sliders and putting grip and stuff down there. So you've obviously, you know, on a wildlife sort of production, you've worked out that there is a, an animal in this area that you want to kind of work with. How do you make that decision? How do you know that it's going to stay there and that you can set up a slider or some sort of, you know, grip situation? How do you know that by the time you finish that, it hasn't wandered off somewhere else?
Well, it's either because I've worked with that animal before, or because I've been, you know, explored that, or it is the other way that I'm working in a team, and, you know, like team, I'm being approached like, okay, we really want to work with this animal, and there's a research team behind it that has scouted about that behavior. But I do say, yeah, I think I'm you know, quite often I'm involved very early on in that process. So because we work together a lot and trying to look at, okay, you know, is this actually from my, you know, my photography point of view, is that working out? And also because I've worked with a lot of sort of, you know, benthic animals that live in one area that are sessile, or they are fish that swim around. It's, you know, you bring in a lot of experience as well from other shoots and other animals you've worked with. So,
So you can kind of predict what they're going to do, or at least kind of know what their parameters are.
Yeah. And I also know what questions to ask, really, with, you know, and to what to explore more with the team I work with. Yeah. But again, I mean, I work in different setups. So I'm both working and like also like creating and producing my own stories that I shoot. But I do work a lot in teams and in bigger production teams on these natural history shows. When there is a research team that you know really scouts for best possible the story they really want to tell, and and the director of that program or of that sequence, because within sort of a lot of the natural history shows, it's sort of more the photography work is a bit more cut up into bits into sort of stories within the show.
How do those stories kind of work in terms of, you know, if you're on a production, like, because you've worked with like the BBC and National Geographic and stuff, if they bring you in on a project and say it's about narwhals or something, have they kind of already sketched out a kind of a story and they're trying to fit the footage to that, or is it more organic in terms of getting the footage and then they kind of build a story? How does it kind of work?
It works in both ways, but I think there is always a strong focus on what kind of story can we tell underwater. That's always paramount, and what kind of behavior can we see? So, and it's both because, you know, underwater camera people have this idea on, you know, this is a story we really should film, and we should really try, because I've seen that happen, and it's definitely worth looking further into and what we can actually do and how we can, you know, visually tell that story. Right. But it is also at the same time that, you know, the research team or the director has already heard about something and, you know, just exploring that more and really discussing how we can tell that story the best possible way.
And so with those bigger productions, like with the BBC and, you know, Disney Plus and stuff, is it always a full production, or are they sometimes just sending you out basically on your own to go and get something?
Well, you know, just it's mostly not going out on my own, but it has happened as well, going out on my own or going out in a very small team. So, I think it's slowly changing a bit to more remote shoots, and obviously, in the whole pandemic time, that's what happened. So I actually went on remote shoots because our like director could come, just couldn't simply travel to Sweden from the UK. And it's one of the right. few shoots I've done for, in Sweden. So,
oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
Because you were stuck at home.
Yeah, I was stuck at home. And so that was like for the BBC Wild Scandinavia series. And right. That's where we ended up going. Yeah, just me and a second camera AC colleague just going out camping on this very tiny remote island full of in the middle of the winter time.
Do you like that sort of thing? Do you like sort of living amongst the animals as well?
Oh, totally. I think it's so much why I really adore and love and thrive in this job, because I mean just the opportunity to be outdoors, to be in water, to spend a lot of time just also observing animals. I mean, and even if I'm not on the job, as what I still, I mean, what I still try to do as much as possible, because it does, even, you know, even just being outdoors and diving and just observing things, I think it's a, I think I started very early on in my diving career as well to be just, you know, instead of just swimming and following like a guided group, I actually sort of just arranged that I could just stay behind in one spot, even if I didn't have a camera with me, just to be observing in one spot. I mean, it's sort of, it's to me a bit like, if you're, I mean, hiking is great and I love it, but if you're just staying put in one spot, actually to see marine life doing things that you wouldn't observe. And I think it's still something I love also working, like say on one exact spot on a coral reef for 4 weeks with, you know, with this particular animal, because you do get to know everyone who's living in those few square meters around you. And you do see their patterns, and you do start to observe also how they behave when, you know, things start going back to normal, because they start, you know, accepting you being
totally.
There.
Yeah.
And just seeing also like light changes and current changes, and it's completely different from sort of the diving style that you know have most of the times.
It's kind of like, it's the difference between going on a tour of like a bus tour of a city, or actually living in that city for a little while. Like
totally.
You get to see so different things.
Absolutely.
So what do you kind of do in terms of recreational diving? Like, do you go out and actually dive without a camera these days, or is it all work for you?
Well, so I go and I do some sort of free dive snorkeling in my free time, but I've actually gotten slowly a bit more active with, just sort of pushing my technical diving, when I have some kind of time. But that's also something where I couldn't continue properly with cave diving, because I felt that it needs a lot of dedication. And when I started doing cave diving, I realized after a while, I just won't be able to, I won't be able to make it, because I was traveling so much with shoots and with work and with projects, and both sort of pushing my career as a cinematographer didn't go together with having an extremely intensive sort of, let's say more recreational approach to cave diving. And it does, I think, in my opinion, it really does require like continuous training to be safe for yourself and to be safe for others, and to really totally maintain those skills and build up your skills. And so I had to go a little bit more into lower key diving in my spare time.
Right.
Because yeah. I also have a family as well. So I've got two children. And yeah, it's it got a bit much with like both, you know, being full on with my work and traveling with my work, being away from home, being away from the family. And then it's, you know, it doesn't really work out to say, okay, guys, see you tomorrow evening again on a Saturday morning. I'm going diving now.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So. Yeah. You kind of have to spend some time at home.
Absolutely. And I'm doing some activity, however, still, and that's something I actually love a lot, is with my ghost net diving group. So I got part of and engaged in this local group of organization as a, by just volunteer people at the Swedish West Coast. And we've been really active in trying to find lost fishing gear, and that's mostly like lobster pods and lobster traps and some nets, and also just, you know, finding rubbish.
Yeah.
And things that, it's a fishing area here as well. And lobster fishing is popular both sort of recreationally and commercially. So it's a lot of work to do, and I think it feels a bit crazy to be picking up someone else's rubbish in your spare time. But on the other hand, I feel it's extremely rewarding for me, because it feels a little bit, it's a way to be giving something back to the to the sea. Because I live off the sea with the type of work I do, and at the same time, it's a way to create some more attention to it, and that's another big part of, you know, the communication about the whole project and the communication about things that are below the surface. And it just gives my work another, and my skills another purpose helping to create and to communicate what's down there. So and I think even though things are, you know, changing slowly, it does help to get media coverage. It does help to have that continuously. And I think we've also at least helped that there was a small change in legislation, which has a big impact on these notorious underwater traps, which these crayfish pots can form, because like what happens is that they trap the animals, and because people use cable ties, plastic cable ties, to lock off the exits, if a trap gets lost, they will eternally keep catching fish or marine animals in them, and they can't escape. Yeah. So
And then they're the bait for the next animal that's going to come in.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I hadn't thought of it that way. Yeah.
Yeah. And so now what has happened is that at least legislation in Sweden changed that is not, it's forbidden now to use cable plastic ties. And
so it doesn't rot? Like, so they have to use metal?
It doesn't rot. So that's the thing. It doesn't rot. So now, you know, everyone is advised to exchange it for just cotton thread, which is cheap and easily available, and, you know, not a big deal. And it's something tiny, but it's, you know, it does make a big difference. And also just raising awareness. So now there's also an app that was created by the local like authorities. So to be reporting lost fishing gear. And that's something we both use, and also where we also report to. So, and our organization works together now with local authorities in terms of reporting, and helps monitor. And if we can't lift it, because we also train a lot in our, you know, in the organization to be handling lift bags and lifting heavy gear, and we get also training by the Swedish Sea Rescue, and you know, we've built like a lot of sort of partnerships to be better doing that kind of job underwater.
Yeah.
But again, it just helps in communicating to the outside, to everyone, both locally and also like on a wider level.
Yeah, so I mean, this this sort of thing, it really does, it just, I mean, it seems like it's small pieces, but it's really just normalizing the idea that you need to care about this sort of thing. You know, it's like every time I go free diving, my wetsuit ends up full of bits of plastic and bottle cop tap tops and all that sort of stuff, because I don't want to see that stuff down there. And then maybe someone will see me putting that in the trash afterwards and going, oh, okay, that is a problem. You know, we need to do something about this. So it's really just ground, like grassroots level sort of, you know, activism. It's great.
Yeah. And again, also, I think there's even an additional benefit of it is that, you know, even we're still out there, we still go dive, and sometimes we just go and, you know, basically monitor also like the local seal population while we're out there. And, you know, we keep a bit of an eye on things. And that is a very important role too. And
well, you're like unofficial caretakers, you know.
We are a bit. And, you know, we got also like a mini ROV now, so we can also, you know, even,
that's awesome. Yeah.
it's really helpful. So but again, so it's easy to keep busy as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But in amongst all of this, you've had time to actually direct your own production as well with the Sharks of the Icy North.
Yeah, exactly. So that was quite unique. It was a very unique project. I had been co-directing for natural history productions before, and also like unofficially been field producing on some projects. So I did have a bit of a background in that. And, you know, it's always like, I do like, as much as I do like sort of having my focus, I'm also quite interested a bit more interdisciplinary. And I think, so I had contact with a commissioner in Germany with Docklights in Germany, and we were discussing on creating a story about sharks. And I mean, sharks, right, that's like 500, 400 species. And that was very much for me an opportunity to just go full on for sharks that I've always been interested in, and that's like the more colder water sharks, which are just much more off the beaten track, both because it's harder to study them, because logistics are more complicated or more expensive, more weather dependent. So there's in a lot of cases even less information available, and at the same time it's very exciting because sharks have so diverse behaviors, and they also live in very diverse and very contrasting environments. So that's really what I wanted to focus in that and tell those stories. And there aren't many films about sharks of those areas and then the colder water. So it was a great opportunity, and also being able to work on it as a director helped me more in terms of the vision I had for telling a story about animals that are difficult in how they compete with, you know, like furry, fluffy, cute animals.
Right, yeah.
And in people are a bit like, oh, you know, sharks. I mean, sharks are visually still a lot of times being portrayed as the you know, fierce hunters, predators. Yeah. It's kind of a big adrenaline rush type thing, and which, you know, of course is very cool. That's 100%. And I mean, that's also why I'm definitely fascinated by sharks.
Yeah.
So, you know, big, fast swimming sharks. Yeah, sure.
But so what did you find when you went out there? Was it hard to find the sharks in those areas?
Because it was very hard to find. And also I had set out for some of the stories where I actually just wanted to find different angles in both, like, the visual style, but also in the story storytelling. I did want to tell more the story about a baby shark and about sort of that process of birth and, you know, bringing out cuteness as well and bringing and still, And that was some. So I actually tried to film the birth of a baby shark for almost a year. It took me I think 5 or 6 attempts, but I was really fortunate to work with a scientific project because it is really hard to find shark eggs nowadays. So because some sharks, they do lay eggs. So you can find people used to find these egg cases of the cat shark species, small spotted cat sharks. But now these days in Sweden, hardly anyone finds these egg cases. And also there are no divers that ever report seeing live egg cases anymore, which they used to 30 years back.
Right.
And we don't actually know where these sharks are giving birth now, if they just move deeper to the deeper water areas that are beyond sort of, that would require heavy weather dependent trimix tech diving dives,
right.
Or what happened, or if they've moved somewhere else. So I did find out, if I ever want to do that, I have to work with a captive set. And that's how I found out, there was an opportunity to work together with this scientific project, which releases the baby, the sharks, when they are a bit older, back to sea. And it was still, even though it was captive and it's controllable, it was still incredibly difficult.
Oh, right. What was the difficulty? What made it so hard?
It's just been both sort of like the technology side of things, where camera failed on me because these sharks, it's difficult to predict when they hatch. So it's like between 7 to 11 months or so period. They would be hatching. And then you get, of course, algae growth on, the egg cases, lighting. It's just to develop a system that was continuously recording. And
okay. So you didn't even, you couldn't even sort of be there. You just had to set something up in case it happened.
Well, with the, if you don't know when they're going to hatch, and it could be between 7 and 9 and 11 months.
11 months.
I couldn't be there. And even though we did sort of observe the development very well, there was a month you could kind of, maybe it was a month to be extra alert. So it was definitely a big challenge, but it was even more beautiful when it actually when it actually worked out. And and at the same time we've been working, of course, in different parts of the North Atlantic for this film. And I think it's both, even though we had quite a good idea where we would be finding the sharks and some of the species, for example, like basking sharks, which are the sort of the second largest sharks, but they are overall quite well to predict. But even then, you just need a week of rough weather, and that strikes out a lot of your plans for that week, of course.
Totally.
And we had to come back several years for some of the shark species. And and at the same time, as you asked me, how did I get into directing? There was also a bit of a practical background behind it, I should say, because at that time, it was also a really good, it was an opportunity for me to work on other parts of film production than the actual cinematography side, because I was when this whole project started and I was in the sort of research and preparation phase, I was actually pregnant with my second child. And producing my own film just enabled that I was in control you know, to to a large extent,
yeah,
on when I was going to go out to shoot and what I was doing. And, you know, I also had work to do that I could do from home. So that was something that was, yeah, really helpful for me to just keep going and what I love doing.
Yeah.
And even though, of course, you know, working with wildlife, working with nature, working at sea with weather changes is always a challenge. And working with a topic that, you know, no one really had done before like that. But at the same time, you know, it sort of both, it was very satisfying because, yeah, again, I did really love the pioneering thought of it, and I did like the process of it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
So, yeah.
So what's next? Is there another project like this on the horizon?
Yeah, so I'm working both on natural history shows at the moment. It's a little bit more open now, so I'm open actually for a new project right now, both in the natural history world, but I'm also preparing a project of my own for, yeah. So that's very exciting to be working on, and yeah, really going through that process. But again, you know, I work at really in different areas of the underwater world. So I'm also continuing to develop on the work I do in underwater, camera operating for feature films. And that's again, exciting as well, because it does allow me to think in a different way and to work in a different way in a team, which I do completely enjoy as well, working in very controlled environments and having much more control on what we do with the underwater cinematography and what we build in water.
I mean, they are very different, you know, beasts, aren't they? Just, you know, from out in the wild, you know, sort of being at the mercy of the weather and then whatever's happening in the water, to then, you know, being on a feature, which usually they want to shoot in a tank and they want to have control over it because it's, you know, they have a timeline and a budget to meet.
Yeah, absolutely. And that is I think, like, in terms of sort of the feeling of pressure that I experience, it's similar, because even if we're out on a wildlife shoot, that we do have to factor in you know, the natural world very much. Yeah. It's still expensive what we do. And but again, it is different when you're at a set and everyone is looking at you, what you're doing, and we know we've got to get it done in just, you know, 2 hours, and, you know, there's no. Everything has to be perfect and to be working, you know, the way we planned it, the way we laid it out. And that's, you know, that's it. So, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, no, exactly. So that's one question that I did kind of think of before, is when you are, like, you know, so you said, you know, your first manta ray trip, you know, you're out there for 2 weeks basically and not sure you're ever going to get the shot that you want. At what point do you kind of pull the pin, or at what point do you kind of say, well, we have to leave?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think it's something I really decide on a shoot by shoot basis, because yes, it is. I think it is just something that comes by experience, really, to be assessing, okay, well, you know, this is just not going to work. We're just fighting upstream and, you know, this is just burning our money here. We should rather focus on something else. I mean, sometimes that's very much a team decision, but again, I can't really, I'm just trying to think of an example where that has happened, but we do obviously like adjust a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you just sometimes can't, you know, if you just have poor visibility, much poorer than you would have usually at that location, and yeah, then you just have to take those decisions to work more macro level, to just, you know, just sort of try to come up with something so you don't have those big beautiful wide shots or Yeah. And
yeah, I guess you kind of, so you just have to sort of, you know, we're here now. What can we make the most of this situation we're in? How can we come out of here with something?
Yeah. But on some of, you know, it really depends, but sometimes you just also have to keep fighting. And I think the only other thing that I have come across with is that, you know, it's sometimes if you're at the mercy of an animal encounter that you know that is difficult to predict, or it might happen in the very first minute that you're underwater, even though you think maybe I'm just still on my test dive.
Right. Yeah.
It might actually happen already then when you didn't entirely expect it.
So you have to be ready for everything, I guess, and highly flexible.
Yeah, you have to be very highly flexible and absolutely be ready.
Yeah. Well, Christina, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for sharing your career and your story. It's amazing. It's inspiring.
Thank you. Well, I mean, I think it's fantastic to be talking to you for real, because I mean, I've listened to you and your podcast a lot. So,
well,
to listen and to be talking to you for real, it's been fantastic. And also, yeah, I think, your work is amazing and has been inspiring me as well a lot, because I think it's so important to be listening and to be looking at other creators, even if that's maybe not always in primarily in that area field where you're working yourself. So,
absolutely, yeah. Yeah, no, that's great. And I get so much out of these episodes. And like you say, like it's, you know, the way that someone approaches something in a whole different niche of this niche can affect how you work or give you ideas and inspire you to other things. So. Yeah, it's amazing.
Absolutely. And I mean, we're often sort of on our own.
Yeah.
And it seems like we're growing all more like a bit closer together. And that's just fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, we've got such a great community. There's so many amazing, talented people in this thing. It's just, you know, it's great to sort of hear their stories and try and, you know, bring them together somehow.
Absolutely. I think it's wonderful.
Thanks, Christina.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening, everyone. And as always, if you like the podcast, please subscribe, review, and share. If you'd like to support with the production of these episodes, you can purchase our very cool merchandise at theunderwaterpodcast.com. We've got branded coffee mugs, stickers, beer cozies, and posters featuring our amazing illustration and logo by Joe Hodenow. If you'd like to connect with us or learn more about our guests, you can reach us at theunderwaterpodcast.com or on Instagram. We also have a Facebook group where you can discuss the episodes and even get your questions answered by our guests. There's a link to it in the show notes. Also, don't forget about Waterproof magazine, showcasing the best in underwater art. Read it online or purchase a print edition at waterproofmag.org. You can learn more about my underwater photography workshops and mentoring at brettstanley.com or Brett S. Photo on Instagram. The Underwater Podcast is presented and produced by me, Brett Stanley, and our music is Neo by Oh Boy. Keep creating, everyone. I'll see you in the water.